This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, thousands of protesters once again on the streets of major American cities. And a New South Wales police officer under investigation over the arrest of an Aboriginal teenager in Sydney.
You hear about these, you know, these stories from your family, but you don't see it, you know, the way that we're seeing it on social media now, which is great.
Look what they've done, you know, tripped him over, like smashed his face to the ground, you know, broken his teeth, like he's got to live with that for the rest of his life. He's not going to trust another police officer again.
In the United States, just hours after President Donald Trump vowed to deploy the military to crack down on violent protests in his country, cities again descended into chaos. At least five police officers were shot and injured around the US. There were mass arrests in Washington, D.C. Stores were looted in New York, and a suburban mall in Los Angeles was set on fire. 18,000 members of the National Guard are now helping local law enforcement agencies in 29 states, and a further 1,500 troops are being mobilised in Washington, D.C., where our North America correspondent Catherine Diss reports.
Despite tear gas before dark and a 7 p.m. curfew, protesters remained on the streets of the capital into the early hours. In a show of force, Black Hawk helicopters hovered low overhead, snapping trees and whipping up debris. The night of chaos outside the highest office in this land, sparked by a decision to rain tear gas on peaceful protests outside the White House to make way for the president as he posed for photos outside St. John's Church with Bible in hand.
We were very shocked and quite frankly outraged.
That's Muriel Bowser, the mayor of Washington, D.C.
People who were not violating the curfew and who did not seem to have provoked attack were attacked and moved out by the federal law enforcement officials.
A swathe of religious leaders have joined the chorus of condemnation, the Episcopal Bishop of Washington, Marianne Edgar Buddy, among them.
He did not come to pray. He did not come to express remorse or consolation. He did not come to share the grief or to provide hope to the thousands of young people who were gathered in the park that day.
Grief and a deficit of hope which played out in cities across the country for a sixth night. New York City was among the worst as this coronavirus-racked community took its anger to the streets. The state's governor is Andrew Cuomo.
Look at the videos. It was a disgrace. The NYPD and the mayor did not do their job last night.
8 U.S. states, including the capital, are holding their delayed primary elections today. In Philadelphia, Joe Biden, the Democratic contender, sought to capitalize on the unfolding crisis.
A country is crying out for leadership. Leadership that can unite us. Leadership that brings us together.
But the anger and grief being vented on the streets is no longer just about the justice for George Floyd. Injustice in this deeply fractured nation has many faces and causes. This is Catherine Diss in Washington, reporting for AM.
And our North America correspondent David Lipson is near the White House in Washington, D.C. David, tear gas was used to clear peaceful protesters from the streets near the White House yesterday. Describe what is happening there now.
Well, there's a huge crowd here today, Sabra, probably two, maybe three times as big as it was yesterday. It's entirely peaceful, and just on appearances, it does look to be somewhat different to yesterday. It looks, to put it bluntly, a little bit more middle class. It's whiter than it was yesterday. It seems that a lot of people have been activated by what happened yesterday with the security apparatus clearing out peaceful protesters so the president could have his photo opportunity. And they're here making their voices heard very loudly. It still is almost entirely about Black Lives Matter, about George Floyd's death and justice for African Americans. But it's an incredibly diverse crowd of people that have gathered here. And not just here, there are different groups roaming around Washington, D.C., holding sit-ins in major intersections and essentially making a lot of noise.
Now, as you mentioned, the protesters, peaceful protesters, were cleared from the Episcopal Church yesterday for Mr. Trump. Has there been any fallout from that?
Well, there's been a lot of reaction. There's been a lot of anger as well, including from the clergy of that particular church who were caught up. They were tear gassed. They were moved on. They were forced out. They were all sort of congregating out the front, offering a prayer vigil and in some cases water and the like for those peaceful protesters. They had to abandon ship. They had to flee so the president could have his photo opportunity. So they are furious. But also many other church leaders are furious as well, and they've made their voices very clear. But you've also seen a few governors start to react as well. So, for example, the governor of Virginia, neighbouring Virginia, who is a Democrat, has refused a request from Donald Trump to send him some assistance in the form of National Guard soldiers. There are other mayors locally and nearby who have pulled their security forces out because they don't want them used in such a way by the president.
Now, most of the protests are peaceful. Is there any sign that the demonstrators are losing their motivation to be on the streets?
It's hard to tell. You know, these things morph and change by the hour. Things were peaceful yesterday, in this city at least, until the president's photo opportunity. In other cities, it's been different. After dark in New York last night, but after peaceful protests during the day, you saw hordes of looters roaming the streets, you know, looting major shopping centres and stores and the like. So, you know, it's just really hard to know. It's a city-by-city thing, and it's an hour-by-hour thing. It's very difficult to predict.
That's our North America correspondent, David Lipson, in Washington, D.C. Dorothy Tucker is the president of the National Association of Black Journalists. She's an investigative reporter for CBS News Chicago. Dorothy Tucker, thanks for talking to AM. There are many examples of reporters and media being mistreated and arrested and shot with bullets and being harassed at protests, in particular African-American journalists. What have you heard?
Well, we are in the process of taking a survey to see just what the numbers are. But I can tell you, in addition to the CNN reporter Omar Jimenez, we know of at least three or four others across the country that, you know, we've either directly, I've directly heard from, or that I have seen their social media post. So, and I think those are just the ones that we're hearing about. We are very concerned about the number of African-American journalists in particular, you know, who are being harassed, being arrested. You know, the police are not acknowledging or accepting their press credentials. You know, it is just, it is unacceptable.
You're Chicago-based. What have you seen in your community over the past week?
A lot of pain. A lot of tears, a lot of destruction in across the city. You know, I've never seen anything like this, not since probably 1968, and that gives you an indication of my age. I was 12 years old when Martin Luther King was murdered. There were riots in the streets of Chicago in 1968, and I grew up in the community, so I remember the destruction then. You know, I remember as a child walking through all the glass and, you know, seeing the broken windows and the looting that had taken place the day after. This is as bad in some regards and worse in others. Unlike then, when the destruction was concentrated to the west side of the city and parts of the south side, what we're seeing today is just this looting across the city, including the suburbs, areas that we would have never have thought you would have seen this sort of thing before. But there are two things that are going on here. You have the peaceful protesters, and then you have the opportunist. You have the agitators that are doing the damage, lighting the fires and looting. So the two should not be mixed. You know, they're not at all. It is not a protest that is turned violent. There are people who are there protesting for the right reasons. And then there are people who are there who are just criminals and taking advantage of this.
Dorothy Tucker, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
It's Dorothy Tucker, the president of the National Association of Black Journalists. She was speaking to me from Chicago. As demonstrations in the US continue, one Washington DC man's captured national attention for helping a group of protesters escape police. When a large protest, which took place in defiance of a curfew, was broken up out front of his house, Rahul Dubey allowed more than 50 demonstrators to shelter in his home for the night, meaning they avoided arrest. Mr. Dubey is speaking here with our National America, North America correspondent, James Glenday.
Why did you take everyone in? What was it about it? Was it the pepper spray?
I was here. I heard screaming. I heard beating. People were getting their heads slammed down on the ground, and they were running for their lives. You opened the door. You would have done the same thing.
So you just thought, enough's enough. I've got to...
I was here. There wasn't enough. There was no thought. It was get in as soon as... you saw them. It was a human tsunami coming this way, and as soon as I saw the pepper spray, I grabbed the door like this. I jumped down this way. This was flung all the way open, and it was get in the house. There's videos. I just for 10 minutes, there was a stream of people running through. And then once the police line got there, I came inside and locked this door. And they were spraying pepper spray in through the window. I walked in and they're throwing milk all over themselves and stuff like that.
So, had you ever expected something like this would happen here?
Never.
Never.
I mean, I still haven't digested that it happened, right? And so I do some work in Medellin, Colombia. I have a couple endeavors down there. It used to be the murder capital of the world, the Comuna 13. It is 10 times safer than what I feel right now on this street in Northwest Washington, D.C., wow. Our nation's capital.
That's Washington, D.C. resident Rahul Dubey speaking there with James Glenday. The arrest of an Indigenous teenager in Sydney on Monday has brought the issue of police and race relations into sharp focus in Australia. A New South Wales police officer is now the subject of an internal review over the arrest. A video of the incident shows him tripping up the 17-year-old while arresting him, causing him to fall heavily onto the footpath. The incident was highlighted by those who attended a Black Lives Matter protest in Sydney last night. Rachel Mealy reports.
While an event on the other side of the world had brought them together, for people in Sydney's Martin Place last night, it was the video of an arrest closer to home that was front of mind.
I only saw it this morning. I wasn't shocked, but I was disappointed. But he was using it. The police officer was using excessive force, even though he was a young fella. He did seem like he was backchatting, but that's no need to use excessive force.
New South Wales police have launched an internal investigation into the actions of the constable.
Oi! You just slammed him on his face!
In the video, the officer appears to kick the teenager's legs and he falls to the ground face first.
What the f*** is this? He's in pain, but I've never heard that.
Indy is an Aboriginal woman from South Australia who was at last night's protest in Sydney.
I felt sick. I thought of my brothers. I thought of my people, and in the same breath, it didn't surprise me. You see this stuff all the time, you know. You hear about these stories from your family, but you don't see it, you know, the way that we're seeing it on social media now, which is great. It's getting those views and it's getting that traction, which is important, you know, but that's why we're here tonight.
Rachel Malone is a Kamilaroi woman from Western Sydney. She says incidents like this one make young Indigenous people nervous the next time they encounter the police.
You can't justify that. You can't justify their actions. Not at all. Look what they've done. You know, tripped him over, smashed his face to the ground, you know, broken his teeth. He's got to live with that for the rest of his life. He's not going to trust another police officer again. As well as a lot of other young Aboriginal people are not going to... They're just not going to trust police.
Keenan Mundine is the co-founder of Deadly Connections, which aims to address the over-representation of Aboriginal people in the child protection and justice systems.
We need to change the way we police our communities. We need to work together. We need, you know, I don't want my children to end up in a situation like that because they're Aboriginal. And I want my community to be safe, and I want my, you know, household to be safe, and I want the police to be safe and go home to their families.
That's Keenan Mundine from Deadly Connections, ending that report from Rachel Mealy and Stephen Stockwell. The New South Wales Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, has told News Breakfast she welcomes the investigation into the police officer who arrested the Indigenous teenager.
I think I thought what most Australians thought, and that is we still have a long way to go in our country, and I appreciate the actions the police have taken in relation to that, in terms of restricting the duties of the officer involved. They're investigating the matter. I think what's happened in the US is a good wake-up call for all of us, and I think all of our hearts are breaking as to what's happening in the United States, and we certainly have to ensure that we do what we can in our own country to protect all of our citizens.
New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian. Today is the last day of National Reconciliation Week. A recurring theme is the disproportionate number of Aboriginal people in prisons and deaths in custody. 30 years ago, the Royal Commission into Deaths in Custody recommended police adopt a system where they'd have to notify Aboriginal legal services whenever they arrested an Indigenous person. It's taken decades for most states to put such a system in place, and some are still to do so. Aboriginal legal services say it can work as long as it's appropriately funded. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
The aim of a custody notification service is to protect Indigenous people in police custody. As Narita Waite, the co-chair of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services, explains.
The CNS provides that accountability measure that as soon as an Aboriginal person is taken into custody, police have to notify the local ACCLs. It means that they can check on their wellbeing and safety, and it also provides culturally safe legal advice specific to their circumstances.
The scheme was a recommendation from the 1991 Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody report, backed up by the 2014 inquiry into the death of Miss Jew, an Aboriginal woman who died in police custody in Western Australia. It's also a recommendation of the 2014 Australian Law Reform Commission report into Indigenous incarceration, but it's yet to be fully implemented. Tasmania, South Australia and Queensland remain without a mandated CNS system.
One of the downsides of that from the government's position is the cost involved.
Greg Shadbolt is the Principal Legal Officer with Queensland's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services. While Queensland doesn't have a legislated custody notification service, police are expected to notify legal services, which Greg Shadbolt says is less effective.
Sometimes we're not contacted by the police until after a client has actually already been charged. So that's obviously problematical. Obviates against any potential for a caution, for example.
He says despite the best intentions of Queensland Police, a lack of resources and funding means the system doesn't work as it should.
If it was legislated, then we would be getting contacted before the event or during the event, as it were, when someone's picked up as a suspect, and not after the event when they've been charged.
Even states that do have a custody notification service, like Western Australia, have struggled to cope with the huge demand. Narita Waite says as Australians debate the need to address Indigenous incarceration rates and deaths in custody, governments should look to properly fund the solutions that have already proved effective.
The CNSs need to be mandatory and funded in every state and territory for ACCLs to run, and not funded at a basic level, but well-funded and well-resourced, so those key activities that I referred to earlier could be carried out in a competent manner. Our CNSs run by Aboriginal Legal Services save lives. You know, we have the solution, we know it works, and now those governments need to urgently develop and fund these services in partnership with us before there's any more grief, pain and loss that's inflicted upon our communities.
And that's Narita Waite from the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services, ending Bridget Fitzgerald's report. Later this morning, we'll see what impact the Black Summer of bushfires and the COVID-19 restrictions have had on Australia's economy. And it might be that our record of 3 decades without a recession could be coming to an end. Economic growth the first 3 months of this year most likely contracted by a third of 1%. A second negative quarter in September will mark a technical recession. But there's nothing technical about it for the million Australians out of work. Here's senior business correspondent Peter Ryan.
Economists have been sharpening their pencils and fine-tuning forecasts for this morning's official GDP reading. Like everyone else, Ernst & Young chief economist Joe Masters has been absorbed in a head-spinning series of shocks so far this year that are likely to culminate in the biggest economic downturn since the Great Depression.
We had the bushfires, which really impacted through that holiday period. We started to close our international borders in early February, which had a really big impact on tourism and students from China. We put social distancing restrictions in place and also domestic travel restrictions. And then adding to all that, we also saw households hoarding. So there's a lot of moving parts in this data, more so than normal.
Most economists expect GDP for the first 3 months of 2020 will come in slightly negative, down a third of 1%, the first contraction since the Queensland floods in 2011. A second negative quarter in September would confirm a technical recession. But Joe Masters says the shock has already hit in a world where the textbook definition is hardly a newsflash to more than a million Australians out of work.
Normally when we get a crisis, the economy slides into recession. But in this case, it's been very unique. We literally closed parts of our economy, unprecedented restrictions around our borders. So the economy literally collapsed.
And we won't see the major contraction until September when the full force of the lockdown restrictions become apparent. How bad do you think that's going to be?
We're likely to see something like 6 to 8% of loss of activity in a single quarter. That's enormous. That'll be the largest that we've seen in decades. And we are expecting the economy still to be smaller in size at the end of 2021 than it was at the end of 2019.
And when we see the technical recession then, that will coincide with the end of JobKeeper. So you're expecting more emergency stimulus to soften the blow?
The next round of stimulus is going to be more around supporting the economic recovery, things like infrastructure spending, but more targeted to particular industries that are still clearly facing an impact from restrictions rather than broad-based support.
Some economists see an outside chance that March quarter GDP could remain marginally positive because of booming exports, stalling the path to a technical recession. But Westpac chief economist Bill Evans says the depth of the crisis isn't a game, and he sees a deep recession later this year, regardless of what the official numbers say.
The economy is going to contract significantly. We're looking at around 5% for the year. For me, that's a recession. So let's hope that we don't get in a debate about do we have a recession or not, because it's only one negative quarter.
And as you say, the reality out there in the real world is starkly different.
That's right. And we must always look at recessions in terms of what's happening to the unemployment rate. And so we're expecting the unemployment rate to still be at around 8% at the end of the year. So that's a jump from 5% to 8% over the year. For me, that's enough to call it a recession.
In a rare encouraging sign, the Reserve Bank says the economic downturn might be less than expected, noting the improving global state of the pandemic and the easing of lockdown restrictions. But leaving interest rates on hold yesterday, Reserve Bank Governor Dr. Philip Lowe says the outlook remains uncertain and that emergency monetary and fiscal support will be required for some time.
Peter Ryan. Nearly one in five Australian charities are at risk of collapse due to COVID-19, according to a new report released today. Disappearing revenues will force most of Australia's 16,000 charities into deficit, and the report says it'll take government help to ensure they survive. With more, here's social affairs correspondent Norman Hermont.
Then the opportunity at Vanguard came up.
This 2017 video shows Vanguard Laundry Services, a social enterprise in Toowoomba, Queensland, at full steam, with a staff of employees who've experienced mental illness busily sorting laundry from hospitals, hotels, and restaurants. Managing Director Mark Gates says it's a very different picture now.
Prior to COVID, we had a staff base of around about 65, 70. We've actually got 40 people that we've had to let go who are obviously on the JobKeeper package. We're down to a core staff of about 16.
Vanguard wants to bring back staff because for many, it's a vital pathway to employment. But Mark Gates says it won't be easy.
When COVID first kicked in, the impacts to Vanguard were instant. It's how you survive for the future, and that's something we're currently working on.
A new report reveals just how hard it will be for charities to survive the coronavirus shutdown. Susie Riddell is the CEO of one of the report authors, Social Ventures Australia.
Of the 16,000 charities in Australia that employ people, many thousands are at risk of becoming financially unviable and closing their organisation.
Using federal government data, the report modelled a 20% drop in revenue due to COVID-19. It found nearly 90% of charities would fall into deficit, and nearly one-fifth would face having to close their doors within 6 months. It's something Franca Smarelli, the CEO of mental health and physical therapy charity Hands on Health Australia, knows all too well.
We're doing it rough. We're doing it tough. Our income has fallen by over 50%. We've had to cancel all our fundraising activities.
The report recommends JobKeeper payments to charity employees be extended past September to prevent a steep fall in funding. And it wants the federal government to launch a fund to help charities transition to new revenue models. For Franca Smarelli of Hands on Health Australia, the race is already on to replace revenue lost due to COVID. But she says they will need government help.
Are we under pressure? Yes, we are. We are under a lot of pressure. We want to make sure that we reopen our doors, and we want to make sure that we look after the people that we've been looking after and the people that have asked us in the last 3 months to look after them. So, yes, the pressure's there.
That's Franca Smarelli from Hands on Health Australia and Norman Hermont reporting there. And in a statement, the Assistant Minister for Charities, Ed Seselja, says the government's extended unparalleled support to the charitable sector and will continue to engage with it as it works to reopen the economy. Even though restrictions are easing, many of us are still spending more time than we usually would inside in a bid to flatten the curve. And experts say all that time we've spent cooped up indoors is part of the reason why there's been a steep increase in the number of reports of image-based sexual abuse over the past couple of months. But authorities say they're having success in getting abusive material removed. Claudia Long reports.
Julie Inman-Grant is used to dealing with the awful side of the internet.
We've probably worked with about 150 different websites around the globe, and some of them are the worst of the worst.
As a safety commissioner, she's responsible for keeping Australians safe online, which includes being one of the first ports of call for victims of image-based sexual abuse. That means somebody taking, sharing, or threatening to share sexual images of you without your consent.
It does cause significant harm, and there's a lot of anxiety.
Recently, there's been a big uptick in reports from victims. From March to May, the average increase was 200%, but the peak was over the Easter weekend, with almost 600% more reports than normal. And Julian McGrant offers a few clues about why it happens to coincide with the COVID-19 pandemic.
Now, this is a combination of what you might call sexting gone wrong. So people relying on digital intimacy tools to share affection, love, sexual gratification, rather than meeting physically in person during lockdown. But we've also seen a huge sextortion scam that's resurged. It comes in the form of an email, which scares people into paying cryptocurrency payments.
One in five women between 18 to 45 will have experienced this kind of abuse. And if you identify as LGBTIQ, that increases to one in four. If you're Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islander, or someone with a disability, that chance goes up again to one in three, according to the commissioner. And there are plenty of barriers preventing victims from coming forward, according to Anastasia Powell, who's an Associate Professor of Criminology and Justice Studies at RMIT.
They're not sure who they can turn to in terms of their friends or family or even making a report, who's going to believe them and who's not going to further shame and blame them for the abuse.
She says removing victim blaming from the equation is crucial to getting help.
Now more than ever, I think it should be clear to us that it is not the exchange of intimate imagery between consenting adults that is the problem here, but in fact the actions of those people who choose to use that to abuse one another.
E-Safety Commissioner Julie Inman-Grant says when victims are ready to come forward, her office is ready to help, with a 90% success rate in getting images and videos taken down.
You know, when you have the government seal and the power of government regulatory scheme behind you, it does cause people to look at their own terms of service and rethink whether it's worth them having those images or videos posted on their sites.
The federal government is planning to unveil a new Online Safety Act, which it says will include a new adult cyber abuse scheme. It's expected to be introduced to the Parliament later this year.
Claudia Long reporting. And if you or someone you know is dealing with image-based sexual abuse, you can call 1-800-RESPECT or reach out to the eSafety Commissioner at www.esafety.gov.au. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.